Okay, good afternoon, everybody. On behalf of Torah Motion, I want to welcome you and to one of our online learning sessions. It's really an honor and a privilege that Dr. Steinberg, with his extremely busy schedule, has agreed to take the time to give the shiur. And Dr. Steinberg needs no introduction. He's really we consider the top person in the world in medical halakha and medical ethics. All the work he does at Shari Tzedek, he's done work in the Knesset, and he publishes widely. And of course, on the side, Keilu, he's the editor of Encyclopedia Talmudit, doing a wonderful job to get that completed. And we've had the honor of having him every year at our medical ethics conference that we run every summer. And it's really an honor and a privilege to have you and to welcome you and to see you. And we should all be well. And Dr. Steinberg will let you take it away. Just if anybody has any questions, everybody should be muted. If anybody has any questions, please put it in the chat box during the class. And then after we're over, if people want to orally ask questions, we can do that towards the end. But Dr. Steinberg.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. For us, it's already a good evening. We are now at 9 p.m. The time is dependent on where you stay. So I don't know who else is staying on. Maybe people from a different time zone. Anyway, shalom to everyone. And unfortunately, this terrible pandemic is also sort of an opportunity to discuss several halachic issues that it brought up. Interestingly, that such pandemics are not the first time in human history. There were many more difficult, in a sense, pandemics that took lives in many, many fold more than the current situation. Hopefully, we'll never get there. Just 100 years ago, 1918, the Spanish influenza claimed 50 million people over the world dead. And in the 14th century, the Black Death, the bubonic plague, took about 25 million people in Europe alone and another 25 million people in China. It's sort of repetitious. It was a different plague, but it came from the same source. Even recently, AIDS so far apparently claimed 27 million lives. So we are, Baruch Hashem, so far, even worldwide, far away from these numbers. Certainly in Israel, unfortunately, there are close to 50 dead people, but if it won't get worse, it will be far away from the plagues and the pandemics that history knew. There are certain things that we can learn from the previous pandemics from an approach of halakha and behavior, and I'll touch upon some of them. I think the major question that some countries have already faced, like Italy, Spain, and perhaps even New York, that is the triage decision, if it will come up. Hopefully, we in Israel will not experience it. At the moment, it goes, Baruch Hashem, very slowly, so hopefully we'll not reach there. But one can never tell, and there are countries that got there, made terrible decisions from a halachic point of view and from, I think, an ethical point of view. I was just appointed by the Ministry of Health to chair a committee to write guidelines in case, chas v'sholom, Israel will get to a situation where triage decisions will have to make. So we are now in the middle of writing those guidelines, which will be different than the other countries that face the same situation. And I'll leave it to the end because I think it's the most important and challenging question to discuss a little bit what the guidelines should be, at least from a halachic point of view. Let me start by saying that the obligation upon every citizen, wherever there is a pandemic, to follow exactly and strictly what the authorities are saying to do is a halachic must. It is both on the person himself, v'nishmarta me'od l'nafshotechem, and chamira skanta me'isura, and there is an issue of pikuach nefesh, but this strict obligation to follow what the governments are saying is also an issue of oidef. If you don't keep yourself from becoming infected, you are progressing the infection to others. Some of them might be compromised from an immunological point of view and die. So it is really a must to follow what the authorities hold. The major preventive measure that we know in pandemics is quarantine or isolation or social isolation or whatever term one can use, which is we should be far as the situation calls for from other people so that we will not infect others. That already was mentioned in the Gemara. When there is a devil in the Gemara, even in Tanakh probably, doesn't mean necessarily a bubonic plague. It might be, but it is a general term for a pandemic, for an infection that goes around in the city or in the country. And there are certain definitions in the Gemara when does such an infection become an endemic infection. But if it is, the Gemara says you have to hide in your room. That's exactly what we are doing now, so many years, 2,000 years later, the same idea, the same understanding that one has to hide in the room and not go out for the fear that will infect others. In the about 200 years ago, when there was one of the seven cholera pandemics, Rabbi Kiva Eger was then in Posen, he was the rabbi there. He wrote three letters which were published in Igrot Rabbi Akiva Eger. One of them is to keep yourself as distant as you can from another one, and even if it is Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, not everyone can go to shul because there's no way to keep the distance. So he divided his community into two groups. One group went to shul on Rosh Hashanah when the other group did not go to shul, and vice versa on Yom Kippur, so that there was always an empty seat between two people, so that they wouldn't touch each other. And during the week, he called for only 15 people to come to shul, again, distancing one from another, and he asked the police to come and supervise that no more than 15 people go in shul at the same time to daven. So history goes back on itself. Unfortunately, some of the rabbis didn't catch the initial outbreak, and they still called to go to daven and to learn in yeshivas. But once it was clear that this is the situation, almost everyone is calling for keeping the regulations of the government in order to keep safe yourself and certainly not to infect others. So that is a general rule since time immemorial, and everyone knows it, and that is how people behaved throughout pandemics. Besides doing what is right to do naturally, there's a whole host of recommendations for tefillahs, what kapit lechtilim to say, avinu malkeinu, and other types of known prayers which are to be said during such a pandemic. And especially, according to the Zohar, it is an important segula in pandemics to say the pitum aktoret. Because as we know, when Aaron HaKohen wanted to stop a negev, a pandemic, an epidemic, he took the ktoret, and that is what stopped the magefa in Tanakh. And from here, the Zohar says that whenever there is a magefa, a pandemic or an endemic, one should say this tefillah, neshalma parim sfateinu, as if we are using the ktoret to stop the pandemic. So these are some ideas on what has been said in previous pandemics. There's an interesting issue about the medical team and anyone else, the healthcare team that has to take care of sick, infected patients. So the rule is that a regular quote-unquote person who is not a physician or a nurse is obligated by the love of Lota Model Dam Recha to do whatever he can to save others. However, according to most poskim, if in order to save someone else, he puts himself even in a sofek danger, he is not required to do it, and some even rule that he is not allowed to do it, even in order to save his friend from a vaday sakona. It's a famous Yerushalmi, won't go into the details. However, medical team, by profession and by obligation, they are the ones who have to take care of such patients. So the rule is that they are at least allowed, and some even say that they are obligated, to take care of patients, even if there's some risks involved in their taking care. However, obviously, they must do whatever is possible to protect themselves from becoming infected, and that is how in all countries the medical team is protected with the appropriate gear so that they will not be infected. However, we know from other countries and even in Israel that some of the health workers do get infected, and it is really commendable that they are still doing it and want to help others, even though they're taking some risk. So halachically, they're allowed to do it. And as I said, some even hold that it's their job and they are obligated to do it, even if they take some risk. But they have to be careful as the regulations are. We are now getting close to Pesach, and there will be some issues, halachic issues, for those who are in quarantine, or like in Israel, that everyone has to stay at home unless he has some important task to do outside. And we in Israel, I don't know what the rules are in the States or specifically in New York, we can't even have children coming to parents or to grandparents since they are not from the same household, and therefore everyone is doing his Seder alone. In fact, my children are doing the first time their own Seder, and they have a whole host of shyness, how do you kasher, and what do you do here, what do you do there, because they never did it in their life so far, but this really prompts them to learn how to prepare for Pesach. So there might be several questions concerning Pesach. The first one is for Bchorim. Whoever is a Bchor has to fast Erev Pesach, but the custom is that if he's doing a Siyum, or even if he's attending a Siyum, then he doesn't have to fast. This Sudat Mitzvah breaks his fast. However, if someone is a Bechor and he sits alone at home, what should he do? So if he knows how to learn, he learns himself a Masechta, he makes a Siyum, you don't need a minion for that, you make for yourself a little Kiddush in the morning after davening, you eat a Rogale, and then you can eat regularly. But if someone, by the way, I made a Siyum, I'm finished today, Masechet Horayot, was a good opportunity for me because it's only 14 daf to learn, so it doesn't take so much. And daf Yud Gimel, the one before the end, talks about priorities, about triage, which is really one of the issues that we'll talk in a minute. So that's the one of the major sugyas in Horayot. But whoever doesn't know to learn enough to make himself a siyum of a masechta of Gemara, there are other options. Certainly, if he can do a siyum on a whole Seder of Mishnayos, everyone agrees that counts. Some even say that if he learns one Masechta of Mishnayos counts if he learns it be'iyun, According to Moshe Feinstein, even a book of Nevi'im, if he learns Be'iyun, it can count as a Siyum, but also he can listen to a Siyum the way we are doing now. If Rabbi Kalman will make a Siyum Erev Pesach, I don't know if you are B'chor, and you want your community to be Yotze, so you can arrange such a Zoom, and we'll see you make the Siyum, we'll see you take a schnapps, and we all can enjoy. So you can do it this way. Another issue is Mechirat Chametz. Usually you go to the rabbi, to the local rabbi. Mistakenly, people think that they are selling the rabbi the chometz, which is wrong, unless they think he's a goy, which sometimes might be the situation. You only give him a harsha'a to sell it to the goy, so that you have to sign a document that says that you allow the rabbi to be your shaliach to sell the chometz to the goy, which he will do one way or another. But if you can't go there to sign, so there are various ways to do it. He can send you the shtar harsha'a by mail or by fax. You can sign it and send it back to him. You can also, some say, give him the harsha'a by phone, even though you didn't sign, but you just gave him the harsha'a by phone. There are now a whole host of sites, of websites, of rabbonim that you can sell your chometz to them by the website, which is also a way to sell. So these can be ways to accomplish this this mission. Another issue for Pesach is burning the chometz. So if you are in a quarantine in a way that you're not allowed to go out at all, or if you used to be to burn your chometz with all your neighbors together, and that certainly is not allowed even for those who are not in full quarantine, then you can just make the chometz little pieces, less than a kezayit, and throw it in the toilet, and that is a way of tashbitu. You don't have necessarily to burn it. However, I think clearly that if you're allowed to go out to the supersal once a day to get supplies, you can go out for 5 minutes with a small piece of chometz, burn it in a few minutes, and you can be mekayim the minhag like every year. One warning, halacha, usually when we daven in a shul, in a minyan, Erev Pesach, many hold the custom to say Hallel in Tfilat Arvit of Leila Seder. However, this Hallel, for even those who say it, was only formed for Tfilah B'Tzibur. So therefore, if you're not allowed to go out and participate in a minyan, you daven yourself at home, you don't say this Hallel in Tfilat Arvit, you will say it in Leila Seder. Another issue that came up in different ways is davening b'minyan. Obviously, we all know how important it is to daven in a minyan, but the chiyuv is only at the rabbonon. So if this is regarded as a potential danger to infect others or yourself, then obviously, sofek pikuach nefesh is doiched rabbonon, and you're not allowed to daven in a minyan. Initially, the Ministry of Health in Israel, at least, at the beginning of the pandemic here, allowed to daven in a shul only for 10 people, if each is standing 2 meters away from the other one. And there were many minyonim this way, and that worked at the time. And as I mentioned earlier, Kiva Eger also did it. He gave a permission for 15 people. I don't know what counts to give a number, 15 or 10 or 20, but he also understood that not more than what is required for a minyan, at least not significantly more, and to be separated. But then the government of Israel said, to daven in a room, in a shul, even if it's only 10 people, is dangerous, but they allowed to daven outside, spread apart 10 people, but being in the open, they felt that still would be okay. And many did it. However, there's a beferish din in Shulchan Aruch that one is not allowed to daven outside, to daven in the field. And the Gemara in Brocha says that whoever davens outside is called chatzuf, because the attention is taken away when you're outside and you see cars and people and all kinds of things happening, so your kavone can't be too good. But since it was a Shas Adchak and people still wanted to daven in a minyan, we can count on the Mishnah Berurah, who says that B'Shas Adchak, you're allowed to daven even outside, and that was how people did it. Later on, and that's the situation today all over Israel, you're not allowed even to gather in the open, so you can't daven B'Minyan anywhere, so everyone has to daven at home, and almost all the Rabbonim, the Poskim, have ruled that everyone should daven at home, and many gave an example that they davened really at home and they didn't go to any kind of a minyan. Some do this in an interesting way. If there are many homes close by, everyone goes out to his porch and he sees the others on the other porches, and that is forming a minyan, and they daven this way as if in a minyan. According to many poskim, that is not counted as a minyan, because it's not enough that one sees each other, they have to be in the same room. And if they're not in the same room, then even if they see each other, it's not counted as a minyan. That's the opinion of the Mechaber, and almost all Sfardi Poskim Paskin, that it doesn't count a minyan, therefore you can't say Kaddish, you can't say Dvorim Shebikdusha, that is not counted. But the Mishnah Berurah holds that it's enough that people see each other, even if they are not in the same room, B'Shat Adchak, that is counted as a minyan, and therefore that may be for the Ashkenazi who go according to the Mishnah Berurah, a way to still daven b'minyan if they have this opportunity to have at least 10 people around close enough. And when I walk around some of the shchunot in Yerushalayim, you can hear someone with a big, loud voice davening before the teva, so that everyone will hear the davening, and that is considered davening. Now, the fact that we are davening b'yichidus and there is no Kriyat HaTorah, obviously, on Shabbos and on Monday and Thursday, that is not a problem, because Kriyat HaTorah is an obligation, b'tzibur. And therefore, whoever is not in a tzibur is exempt from the chiyuf of Kriyat HaTorah. It's nice to go over Shnai Mikra V'Echad Targum anyway, and while you're davening, if you read to yourself from the Chumash, the Parsha is again nice, but there's no Chiyuv. The Chiyuv is only B'tzibur. Another interesting issue has to do with mikveh. Men that still keep the Takonos Ezra to go to mikveh before davening, in Israel at least, it is totally forbidden. The mikvahs for men are not the most hygienic places that you can find. And usually many crowd together in these few minutes before davening, and therefore that is not allowed. However, those who hold this minhag can use Tisha Kabin, which is certainly enough for our time to be Yoitze Takonos Ezra. And what it means is to stand under the shower for 4 or 5 minutes and letting the water run on you, that is equivalent to tvila for a man who still keeps Takanos Ezra. With women, it's different, obviously, because a woman has to go to the mikveh when time comes. And in most mikvahs, for women, it's usually much more hygienic and clean and neat, but it has to be really done according to the rules of to keep it as sterile as possible, with the right amount of chlorine in the water, with changing water at least every day, and being every woman alone when she comes to Tvilat Mitzvah. So these are some of the issues that have been resolved even in our day of isolation. Another interesting issue is if you buy for Pesach new kelim made by goyim, and if they are made of metal or similar material, you need to toivel in order to use it. But since you can't get out of your home and there is no open mikveh for kelim, so there are two ways to get around it. One is to give it as a present to a goy and then borrow it from him to use. So since you gave it to the goy and now it's a kli that belongs to a goy, a kli that belongs to a goy doesn't need tvila, and you are just renting it from him, and when hopefully everything will settle back, then you can be toivel it, but even then without a brocha, because you used it already as a borrowed kli from a goy. Shlomo Zalman suggested to be mafkir the kli before three and not willing to get it back, but then if they say we don't want it, then you can take it back, and then it's your kli that you are Israeli and you're not mechuyev betvila. So these are ways to do it. Another issue is if chas v'sholem we have to bury a coronavirus dead person who is very infecting in his situation. The chief rabbinate here in Israel decided that such person should be wrapped by double wrapping of a plastic sheet, close it up without tahara, without tachrichim, take him the way it is, without levaya of any other people except for the few chevra kadisha, and unfortunately bury him this way, even though in Israel you have to put the body touching the earth, but and here he will be there will be a chatzitza of the plastic sheets, but since it's very infective, there is a heter to do it this way even in Israel, and obviously everyone taking care of this body has to be strictly covered and like the physicians who treat live infected people. So these are some of the issues that come up. I am also in my spare time the chairman of the board mila in Israel, and I just issued rules and regulations how to do a bris in these days. So we know as a fact that babies, certainly newborns, probably are not infected, and there's no reports. If there is, it's just a very rare case reports of babies becoming infected. So the baby per se is not regarded as a choile unless his mother is known to be a carrier of the virus, either before she delivered or right after she delivered. And since the baby is with her, and she nurses the baby, and he's very close to her, then there is a suspicion that he might have been infected, and he has a din of a choile kol gufo, and moreover, there is a danger that he will infect the moel or the sandek, whoever is close to him, and therefore the mila should be postponed after the 14 days that the mother was in quarantine and tested negative, at least on two tests, that she really is not anymore carrying, or if she was suspected to be a carrier, that she's not a carrier. That is true not only for the mother, but for anyone who is taking care of the baby. It can be the father, it can be a sister, or whoever is close to the baby. If they were either infected or were suspected to be infected and they were in quarantine, the birth should be postponed after completing the quarantine time and the baby is okay. Also, the chief rabbinate ruled that in these days, even those who are makpit on metzitza bepeh, there should not be metzitza bepeh. It should be by shfoferet, because getting too close with the face of the moel to the baby, if the baby is infected or if he is infected, might cause infection to either of them. And although I don't know that the coronavirus is transmitted via blood or via wound, we don't know enough about this virus, and therefore, to be careful, we are postponing the bris, the metzitza bepeh, until better times, and then whoever does it can resume it. Now, as I said, the major issue will be in Israel, hopefully not, but theoretically, if we'll come to a situation where there'll have to be a triage, and there have been already countries like Italy and Spain and France that made rules of triage, which certainly are not in accordance with halacha or with what I consider an ethical approach. So the concept, and we won't go into all the details because there are many, many details on how to deal with a triage decision, but some general ideas. First of all, if many come together, many people who need a treatment that is short, and in our case, in the corona case, it might be either not enough ICU beds, not enough respirators, or not enough personnel, experts in taking care of patients who are on a respirator, either of those will create a situation where not everyone that needs these treatments can get it. Now, in halacha, there is a distinction between a situation where people come together at once, bevat achat, and they need a certain treatment which is not available for everyone, then certainly you have to triage because you can't give everyone this treatment since there's not enough. So if they came together, one can get it and the other one will not get it. So that is clear that you need a system to triage. But there is another option where the patients come one after the other, b'zeh achar zeh. So if a patient comes, and now I have an available ICU bed and an available respirator, and he is in need of the respirator, so kol hakodem zacha, and he comes, so he should be put on the respirator. Now, the next one that comes doesn't have an ICU bed or doesn't have a respirator, so too bad, he can't be treated. But how about if the first that came is someone who is dying anyway from another disease? He has metastasis all over, and even if I'll treat him with the respirator, he won't make it. On the other hand, the next one who came after him is a young, healthy person that needs now the respirator to overcome the corona infection, but he will make it. So should we still say that whoever comes first is first, or we can a priori triage, because we can assume a priori that in a situation where there will be many, many in need of respirators, even though at the moment the one who came has a free respirator, I know that in a minute there will be someone else who is in a better situation than the one that came first. And can I spare it from the one that came first and give it to the second? That is a bit of a machloikes. I won't go into the sides of it. But assuming that if chas v'sholom there will be a situation where it will be such a condition that there will be many who are in need and there will be not enough to supply to everyone, they will come together by definition. And therefore, I think it's clear that we are talking about Bar Bevat Achat. And then there are rules who gets first the treatment, the life-saving treatment. There is this sugya in Horayos, as I said, in Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, there's a famous Mishnah that makes triage decisions according to the importance of the person from a Kedusha point of view, Kohen Kodem LeLevi, Talmid Chacham Kodem LeAm HaAretz, and so on. There are many such grades, but most of the poskim hold, including Moshe Feinstein, Shlom Zalman Loyerbach, and others, that these rules cannot be applied nowadays. We can't see that you came to you 15 corona patients who need a respirator, and you'll say, who knows Mishnayos Bava Metzia by heart, he will get the first respirator. That obviously is not something that we can do. Or who is a Kohen, and are you really a Kohen? Bring me proof that you are Kohen. You say you are Kohen because you want to be first, but maybe you're not. That is impossible in such situations, and therefore it doesn't apply. There are other sugyas, both in Shas and in Rambam, to triage from a halachic point of view, but many of them are irrelevant to this particular situation. Again, I don't want to go into a lengthy discussion. But almost all poskim agree that the rule is that the one who is in need of the treatment and has the greatest chance to survive if he gets the treatment, he will get first. So if two people come who are corona sick, and one is a moderate level of sickness and he still can go along and he doesn't need, medically speaking, he doesn't need a respirator, and with him comes someone who is in a very severe respiratory failure, obviously the one that needs it now will get it. But if two people come and one has severe underlying diseases, knowing that if you'll give him the respirator, he won't make it anyway, or the chances are very slim that he will make it with the treatment, and together with him comes someone who is basically healthy but needs the respirator just because the corona pneumonia, then we will give it to the one who has better chances to survive. So these are the basic rules which I think most of the triage decisions all over the world are operating, and that is also the halachic approach. There are complicating situations. For instance, two people who came, and they are equal. Their condition is similar. Both have the same underlying diseases, or both are healthy totally except for needing the respirator, and I have only one respirator. So who do I give it if I don't have any distinguishing features from a medical point of view between the two? So here there are at least three options. One is to do a goral, just to make a chance choice by a goral. Second one is whoever came first will get first, but sometimes they came together, so that won't be an option. And the third one is to give randomly, whatever someone decides will be good, even though someone else could have decided differently, but since they are equal, it is a random decision. That's the position of the Chazon Ish. Rabbi Israeli wanted to do a goral. These are some of the options to do. I think medically today, most would agree that you go randomly whatever the feeling of the treating physician is, that's the one who will get it. Another complicating situation might be that someone came who is in need of the respirator, and at the time that he came, he seemed to be appropriate to get priority of his treatment. Let's say he came in, he is relatively healthy, there are no underlying diseases, he's in a severe respiratory distress, and the assumption is that if he'll be on the respirator, he will make it. So he gets the respirator. But unfortunately, he deteriorates. And we have seen several such cases that started as if with very good chances to survive, and something happened, which we are not always sure what it is, because we don't know enough about this coronavirus, and he deteriorates. Now, he is deteriorating, and even though he is on a respirator, he will not make it, based on the situation that we see him now. But it will take days, maybe a week or so, and in the meantime, another person comes who is in good condition, whose chances, as we see him now, are much better than the one that is already on a respirator. What do we do in this situation? So in general, almost all poskim hold that withdrawing a respirator, which will lead to the death of the person on a respirator, is a forbidden act. Some hold it's a retzicha, other ones hold that it's less than a retzicha, it's maybe a gram retzicha, but it's usually not allowed. The question is, if in this situation, where keeping the person who deteriorates continuing on the respirator and not giving it to someone who has a chance to survive, we actually causing a situation that both patients will die. The one on the respirator will die because he deteriorates unrelated to the respiratory failure, and the one who is in need of the respirator will die because he didn't get the respirator. So is there a way out? So there are several ways that Shlomo Zalman Auerbach ruled on. One was actually concerning my father, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha, that was in a certain situation that I asked Shlomo Zalman what to do, and he ruled on it, and that was published further on, and we used this. And there are many other situations. Again, without going into too many details, there are several ways to act on behalf of the patient whose chances are very slim on the respirator, without removing him from the respirator, letting him die earlier than if I would give him the full treatment, and then having the respirator free to save someone else that has greater chances to survive. So that is an option that, according to Shlomo Zalman, Rav Rozner, and many other poskim, is allowed to take, and actually we have used it in several cases where a patient had a DNR order for himself, but it wasn't known. And he came into the emergency room unknown, and obviously the first thing that an emergency room physician does is, if you need intubation, you intubate. You don't have time to look into the question whether he wanted it or not, because if he didn't want it, because if he did want to survive, by the time that you are looking into it, he'll die. So there's no time to look into it, and you intubate. Now, after he's intubated, it turns out that he has a living will, that he didn't want to be on it, and the family is very angry. Why did you do it? And now he's suffering. What can we do in this situation? So in this situation, sometimes in extreme situations, we use some of these measures that I mentioned. But certainly in an epidemic, when the physician assesses the one who is on a respirator, that there's no chance that he will make it even with the respirator. But on the other hand, we don't want to do an act of disconnecting him and killing him right away. We can use these options on reducing the level of treatment and let the patient die on the respirator and then take the respirator for whoever is in need of it. So these are some of the major issues that the corona pandemic brought about from halachic point of view. There are obviously many more issues depending on the timing when it is. Purim, there were shailes. How do you read the Megillah? How do you be yoitzer on Zechiras HaMolek? And all kinds of shailes that were at that time. But obviously, there will be many more shailes as time goes on. But I think that this gives sort of a broader aspect of the dealings that we have with this pandemic. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Steinberg. Thank you very much. I think maybe the first thing, if you don't mind, if you want to take a look at the chat box, there are a few questions there. And maybe you want to take a look at that. If anybody has any other questions, you can do the chat. We can put it in the chat box, or perhaps afterwards you can ask it yourself. But do you see the box, Dr. Steinberg? Otherwise, I can read you the questions if need be.
Well, I see one long question.
Right?
Yes.
A question I was asked this morning. A woman in her 90s with advanced dementia is in care of two long-time aides. One of the aides informs the patient's family that she had contact 3 days ago with someone who herself had contact 10 days ago with someone who has tested positive. The family has two questions. One, the woman with dementia has had these aids for years and would have a very hard time adjusting to new aids. Should the family keep the current aids despite the risk? And two, does the family have an obligation to inform the company that employs the aids? Previous question, the aides stated explicitly that they are not planning on informing their employer. So if I think that's more a medical question than a halachic question, because if it is someone who was in touch with someone who was tested positive by, at least as far as I know, by the Ministry of Health in Israel, that is not considered someone who needs to be worried. It's only the one who was first in touch with someone who is proven to be a coronavirus positive. So if the aide would have been in touch with someone who is a corona positive, then the question would be more serious. But since she was in touch only with someone who was in touch, that second degree relation, as far as I know, is not a real risk, certainly not to continue to give it to someone else. However, since we are talking about a 90-year-old woman, she certainly is in a very high-risk group if she gets coronavirus. So it should be more seriously taken. And if there is an option to find someone else, I would think that it's a precaution that one should take. But if not, I don't see a reason to take her away.
Rabbi Turchiner, do you want to follow up on that question or not?
Thank you. That actually answers the question, I think. Certainly, I understood it to be a medical question also, rather than primarily halachic. I think the issue of them informing their employer, I guess, follows then from there. In other words, if they're not considered to be such a risk because it's this contact through a contact, then I guess that also means there's no obligation to inform the employer?
Right. I think these are the regulations, okay. At least here. I don't know. Maybe different countries have different regulations, and maybe even here, with time, they changed what were the regulations. But again, if she was in touch directly with someone who is corona positive, not someone who is in touch with another one, but directly corona positive, then I think she has to inform, because even if this family will release her, she will go to another family, and that shouldn't be done. So she should be quarantined, and after 14 days, hopefully she'll be fine, and she'll go back to work, but it has to be reported. She's right. Not losing her job. She's just, she needs to be quarantined for 14 days.
Right. I'll just note also, there was a question above mine on the chat. I think it was lost as scrolled down.
Rabbi Wiener, I think that was your question, right? You have one up and one down. If you want to say it orally, maybe that should make it easier. If you're, that's okay. Rabbi?
Sure. I had a few. Hi, Dr. Steinberg.
Hi.
And I forgot some of them that I wrote as I was listening to Dr. Steinberg.
One of them was about age. One of them you want to know if age could be a factor alone, a primary factor in giving a respirator. I saw that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So the answer is certainly halachically, Moshe Feinstein, Flom Zalman, everyone wrote that age per se is never a factor not to treat a person. That is a clear rule. Doesn't matter what age, it's a clear rule that age per se is not a factor. And by the way, this committee that I'm chairing now, that we didn't finish yet, but I got already some reports both from the medical team and the ethics team and the legal team, and certainly the halachic team, all agree that age per se is not a factor. However, if there is other issues with this person, say he has an underlying condition that makes him a high risk to succeed with the respirator, then the age may add to the risk factor, but not per se. In fact, we are now keeping people in Israel. I think the average age is between 88 or 90 years of age that are on respirators in Israel. Many of them also have underlying diseases, and yet still, since there's no shortage of ICU beds or respirators, they are getting treated. If we'll get Chas v'Shalom to a condition where we'll have to make triage decisions, then if it is an old person plus underlying diseases, then it will be a factor. But age per se is not a factor.
Okay, I'll just ask, you know, Joey Free's question for you, if you don't see. If a person on a respirator knows he's going to die, can he consent? Can he volunteer to be removed from the respirator to be used by healthier patients who should recover?
Well, most poskim hold that not, because it doesn't matter if he agrees to be murdered, that doesn't make the murder easier. If we regard actively removing a respirator from a patient leading to his death, not as a weaning process, but really leading to death, then his consent is meaningless. He can't consent that someone should kill him. That has no bearing. He can consent not to be put on a respirator to begin with. That is permissible. If he meets the conditions of a chayeshah, of a dying patient. But if he's already on a respirator, whether he agrees or not is the same situation.
Could we rely on sort of the few poskim who say it isn't murder? There are one, or, you know, there's a minority opinion. Can you say that? I want to rely on those opinions.
Well, again, it doesn't matter if he wants it or not. There is a minority of, I don't have to call it a minority, there are very important poskim, Shlomo Zalman and his son-in-law, Zalman Chaime Goldberg, and I just a week ago discussed this matter with Rabbi Moshe Weiss. And they all agree that there are extreme situations where it is clear that the patient is going to die very shortly, no matter how active I'll keep him on a respirator. They say that one can consider, and I'm saying it very carefully, one can consider removing the respirator to save 7 days, but that is said only in very, very extreme situations. I don't think that we should use it as a norm that may lead to a slippery slope, and I think it's preferable to reduce the parameters so that the patient will die sooner and free the respirator and not withdraw the respirator immediately.
Dr. Benisti, you want to say your question? Dr. Steinberg, you see if you scroll down, if someone is not following the quarantine, basically, can you report someone? Can you inform the authorities if somebody? Yeah,
absolutely. And even Reb Chaim Konievsky published a letter saying that if you know that a person has to be in a quarantine and he violates it, you should report it to the police. There's no din moiser if it is done to save people. If he's a roidef, there's no din of moiser.
Okay, does anybody have any questions? I'd like to, I think there's one more question on the chat box, if I'm not
yeah. Dr. Steinberg, I had two other questions that were actually both halacha l'maisa questions related to shortages in PPE. One has to do with staff who want to be on the front lines and they want to help and they're young and healthy and there's shortages. What is the level of risk they're allowed to take when they do not have proper PPE to care for COVID patients, but they want to do it?
Well, I think the risk for a healthy person, even if he contracts the virus, is according to the statistics that we have. And again, I'm warning that we don't know enough of the coronavirus. It's a very unusual virus so far. And since we don't know enough, we don't know what the real level of risk is for young, healthy people if they get it. But so far, at least statistically, we know that there are very, very few cases of young, healthy people who got into serious risk. Now, since we don't know what the risk is, and it might be more significant than we know now, I think that is a risk that even a healthcare provider shouldn't take. Because Sofek Skone to the rescuer is not Doiche Vada Skone to the one that you want to treat, even if you are a professional. But if you are protected even not to the highest level as required and is really the right way to do, again, if medically speaking, the risks are low, then one is allowed to do it, certainly if he needs to help. But again, it will depend on the level of risk. I always say it almost jokingly, but it's not a joke, that the risk of driving in Israel is sometimes greater than taking a risk of taking care of a coronavirus patient. And yet we do it all the time. So there the rule is kivan de dash dash. If it's done regularly, if people take this type of risk regularly, then one is allowed to take this risk, even though it is a significant risk, statistically speaking. And it's not only because you might be a bad driver, you may be an excellent driver, but someone else might be a bad driver and you are risking your life going out with your car. Certainly, if you do it for a good purpose, if the risk is not significant, then one is allowed to take the risk. And I refer you to the Or HaShulchan, who writes very nicely that technically speaking, from a halachic point of view, you don't have to take risks on yourself. You can, there's lo tamad al dam recha, only if there's no risk. However, he says, if you are responsible to take care of people and they rely on you and it's important for you to do it, you should not be a big machmer on yourself, on pikuach nefesh, but rather be machmer on pikuach nefesh of the one that you want to treat. So you have to judge it. It's a matter of judgment. Today, it's more than just a judgment. It's a matter of statistics. And if we know the statistics, we can answer it better. And as I say, up to now, most young people are doing okay. But there are reports of young people who didn't make it. So it all would depend on how great the risk is.
Uh-huh. And the other question related to that was, we're already beginning to see universal DNR policies about all COVID patients, where the staff is arguing that they have shortages of PPE and the risks involved with resuscitating a patient who is COVID positive. What does Dr. Steinberg say about such DNR policies for COVID patients?
Again, you mean that the one that can resuscitate him is the one that is not well protected?
Well, they are well protected in the case of a code, but it still uses up a lot of resources. And because of the risks involved with coding such a patient where the COVID becomes aerosolized, they're afraid that, you know, coding COVID patients is going to be extremely risky and use up resources. And so they take it into account when making DNR decisions.
But who is making the DNR decision? Is
the hospital unilaterally?
So that's a problem. That depends on who the patient is. If the patient has good chances to survive, then that's part of the treatment that you take the risk. It was the same with AIDS and with Ebola and all the infectious diseases. We face the same question that you can treat them when you are protected to a certain level of safety. And then someone has to do it, because if the patient has a chance to survive, I think that's the obligation.
But not if they don't have good chances of survival.
If they don't have a good chance of survival, then that becomes a serious factor.
Thank you.
We'll take one more question if anybody has a question to honor Dr. Steinberg's time. We'll take one last question if somebody would like.
Can I ask a question, Jay?
Vakasha Laser. Go ahead, Vakasha. Okay.
Shalom, Rabbi Steinberg. Always a pleasure. I was just wondering if there's a question on the chat that I would like if the Rav would mind just maybe expanding on. The question on the chat is, what are the ways that the Rabbanim have suggested in terms of hastening? We talked about reduction. You've alluded to the Rav Shlomo Zalman in terms of some suggestions. In COVID, we don't have the same luxury that we have when we talk about normal trying to wean a ventilator, as in your Sfarim that you have. Can you comment about how we do it in these situations where you have patients that are immediately in need as opposed to theoretically being just trying to wean?
Right. So if, for instance, the patient is on a dopamine drip because of low blood pressure, so you're allowed not to renew it once it's finishing. And usually it doesn't take long, someone who is dependent on dopamine, that his blood pressure will drop, and even though he's on a respirator, the heart will stop. So that sometimes is helpful. Someone who is on dialysis, and he's very dependent on dialysis, if you stop the next cycle, sometimes it goes very quickly. If you reduce the levels of the parameters of the respirator to a very low level of oxygen and of peak pressure and so on, it may take maybe a few hours, sometimes even a little less. So that is the limit that we can use these techniques. Sometimes it goes a little quicker and sometimes not. It is not usually, unless, like I said, a dopamine situation, that it will happen within minutes. That, by the way, many coronavirus respirator patients, even if you remove the respirator, they don't die instantaneously. It also takes time. So unless you kill them actively, in many cases, there's no choice but to wait a little, even if you remove the respirator. So I think that these can be helpful, but not for an immediate need. Also, if we would have been successful with the timer that we wanted to put on respirators, there would be an ideal situation where I think everyone would have agreed that to put such patients on a respirator with a timer, and the time runs out, and if he still is doing better, to renew the timer, and if we see that it deteriorates, not to renew the timer, that would have been an excellent solution. But unfortunately, we weren't able to produce this timer.
How come? Can I ask why? What's the problem with making the timers? Is that a manufacturing?
It's a technological
technological.
But we overcame it in Israel. The problem was that the Helsinki committees requested that patients on for the experiment stage would give informed consent themselves. And it's very, very hard to find a patient who needs a respirator that will give an informed consent. Usually they are totally out. And they didn't want to rely neither on family nor on a surrogate. And we just couldn't find enough patients to go through the Helsinki process.
Okay, Dr.
The IRB, the Institutional Review Board. In Israel, it's called Helsinki.
Okay, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Steinberg, really for taking time and for information and talk. Always a pleasure to learn with you. We look forward to learning with you live in person at a live medical conference. Bavakasha. I want to wish everybody well, Chag Sameach, should be healthy for all of us. So we do have a class this evening, Dr. Reinhold on free will. He's excellent. For those who have not heard him, a professor of philosophy at Tishiv University, Bernard Revel. Tomorrow morning, Dr. Ari Zivotofsky on the history of soft and hard matzah. And we'll please God be continuing these classes on good situations and in less good. This has been a tremendous opportunity for learning for all of us. And I want to thank everybody for coming and want to wish everybody well. And like I say, to be healthy and to have a meaningful Pesach. And thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you. And Chag Kasher V'Sameach. And please keep healthy and well, all of you, and be careful with the challenging times.
Amen. Okay, thank you.